Oh, the shame that will get if you let all the fans down.
Can we not lock this?
It's a fact. I am not playing mind games. I am talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladici, I would probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions I don't know. Religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you, except for those two, have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
And I suggest you shut up and show more football.
All right, welcome along to Team 33. I'm Raf Giallo, back in studio after phoning it in for 3 or 4 weeks. But we're on Twitter as usual at Team 33. We're on Facebook. We're also on YouTube and also on iTunes. And I think I've remembered how I always do the intro in the same robotic way that I always do. And Joe Coffey, good man, has been filling in the last few weeks. Jonathan Higgins is back, though, from Madrid. Kian Roach is in studio. And Derek Ryan has also made it in. I think the best place to start is a very quiet weekend in Madrid for Jonathan Higgins. You were just over there on holidays, wasn't it?
A nice city break there. Yeah. An incredible couple of days. Fantastic city. Great occasion. Great, incredible heat. It's a bit of a reality shock being back in Colwatt, Dublin again today. An incredible couple of days. The atmosphere, everything that was kind of good about football, everyone gathering together and a lot of good fun had. No real trouble, thankfully, which is a little concern you would have initially, if particularly with two English teams, you'd fear the worst at times.
Were there fans mixing Spurs?
Yeah, it was great. Right. There was a lot of I think Liverpool fans, from what I saw, completely outnumbered them, but there was great little, you know, just good fun, people enjoying themselves, mixing back and forth, singing back and forth, having a laugh. I'm sure there was a couple of yahoos, there always is, but by and large I didn't see anything, I didn't witness anything, and it was a great occasion, a great couple of days. I suppose the match itself, I'd say for a neutral watching, probably was metabolic enough and boring enough, but
it wasn't great.
It's a professional job.
I don't
job.
Know what everyone else here thinks. Anyway,
that was awful
from TV. Yeah. Anyway, it was just
it was awful. But that, for finals,
but yeah, like it was
never got going.
It got going,
and then just after that early penalty, then it just seemed.
Yeah, I thought
after
26 seconds. Yeah, the first 26 seconds were really good.
Does that come from like the familiarity of both teams together? Like it. Would that, because they'd already played each other like domestically, would that add or take away to the tie? Like I kind of felt from the get-go it'd probably take away from the tie.
In a one-legged game as that final would be, because obviously City and Spurs' two ties were brilliant games. Yeah,
but massive nerves as well. Obviously both teams are afraid to make any sort of mistake, and Spurs made that mistake after 26 seconds and they're afraid to make another one. And then I think the worst thing, well, like Liverpool rightly, you know, on a 1-0 lead, you're kind of... You don't want to push forward too much and give away a goal. So like they were slightly holding back from the explosiveness and that they can have. And Spurs, Harry Kane. I mean, Firmino obviously for Liverpool was poor. Harry Kane for Spurs was poor. Dele Alli. There's a few players who just didn't perform. But the Harry Kane thing backfired. Listen, it was a risk that they had to take. Yeah. It's Harry Kane. You're not going to not start him if he's anyway fit. But still, it did backfire. And Firmino backfired. Well, it didn't backfire for Liverpool, but Firmino was poor as well for Liverpool.
Pat never made a good point regarding the fitness of Harry Kane, and that if he said, if you're not sure of his fitness and that he says he's fit, that you should go and start them anyway. Because if you don't start him and you bring him off the bench and he's not fit, and then you have to pull him back off again, you've already used two subs on the same player, which I thought was a good point and I didn't really factor in, but... probably from the get-go, I think it's hard to criticise Pochettino for playing him just because of the temptation of what he brings to the team, but I don't know, like, your heart would almost be just give to Moura just for what he did in the semi-final.
It's very harsh on Moura.
It's very harsh on Moura.
Like, scoring a hat-trick, I mean, and the way that he did, scored the hat-trick and then to be dropped completely. I can completely understand why Kane started. It's Harry Kane. If it was any other player in the Spurs team, you'd say no, but it's Harry Kane. He had to start. And the way Harry Kane is, you know, he'll get on the end of a dodgy pass, a ricochet in the box, and put the ball in the net, and that's the risk taken, and it's proved like a good decision if that happened. The only thing was, 26 seconds on the clock. Obviously, Liverpool scored the goal so early. He had to stay on them for 90 minutes. You're not taking Harry Kane off if you desperately need a goal, and he probably was. He shouldn't have played 90 minutes. In a normal game, he wouldn't have played 90 minutes. So he had to, because they were chasing a goal. You're not going to take him off. And that was the issue. And I think maybe if they could have brought him on, like I say, with half an hour left, it might have been a better decision. But
it's not just 90 minutes. Yeah. Like, you were in the stadium, obviously, and the heat.
Oh, the heat was incredible.
We were being told about it, but
until you're there and you witness it, like, honestly, like, we came into the stadium, was in there quite early, and I sat down and I almost had a good dehydration headache. It was that warm, it was that humid, it was that stickiness, and it maintained that heat pretty much the whole way through the game. So it's no surprise that as a result of that, particularly, we're talking two English teams. I know there's lots of other different nationalities, but by and large, it's completely out of their climate zone. The Harry Kane thing for me was, you know, did a lot of work in the build-up, and, you know, that was the big question, would he start? And as a Liverpool fan, I was hoping he would, because I would have been worried if he'd gone with Moore and gone with Son, because he could get in behind Liverpool. There was weaknesses there. Kane made it so easy for Liverpool. He made it so easy for Liverpool to sit in because he wasn't fit, and he struggled big time on the heat. And it was interesting to know, there was an interview with Jordan Henderson afterwards, and there was a kind of an interaction one stage between himself and Harry Kane, and he was asked about it afterwards, and his reaction was quite funny. In for a fact, it's probably a guy that's probably itching for a move to one of the Spanish big teams, in maybe not short term, but definitely in a couple of years. He would have thought his career will progress that way. But he made a strange comment. He said, "God, it's really hot here. I'm struggling in this heat." So that's probably a kind of indication of the way the game went for him. But he made it so easy, because the way Liverpool are set up with the fullbacks slightly forward, and you just have the two centre halves and pretty much Fabinho sitting, everyone else is kind of forward. Now, they were a lot more reserved, but Kane being so static, anytime the ball went to him, he was slow and laboured. Whereas if you had the two runners run into the bags of space either side, I would have been worried. And, you know, there was a couple of occasions where there was one in the first half and Song had another one. I think Van Dijk did well to come back, but if there was a lot more of that, it would have been a lot more of a threat. And I thought it was like I'm a huge Pochettino fan, but I thought he slipped up big time there. He really bowed to the temptation, and you'd question how much Kane has a kind of, I know he's the big ego, you go back to that FA Cup tie as well, where he comes on against Tremere earlier in the season as well, just to try and boost his stats a bit. You'd have to question that for me,
like Ronaldo, like, you know, you've got Ronaldo and Messi. I'm not saying Kane is at that level, obviously, but like Kane is the Ronaldo or Messi for Spurs. He is their, without a doubt, their star player, and he's the guy who gets on the end of a ricochet in the box. Is my point. He gets on the end of stuff and knows where the ball is. Knows where the goal is. Knows where the net is. So for me, I mean, it depends on how he was in training. We don't know what he was like during the week. The fact that he played 90 minutes means he was obviously somewhat fit. Oh, he wasn't great for 90 minutes, but the fact that he was able to play for 90 minutes at all shows he was obviously somewhat fit. He wasn't fit enough. And looking back, you know, given the chance, if they could play the game again, Pochettino may drop him, and that'll be a different decision. But for me, it's a risk that you kind of had to take.
I would have gone completely the contrary. I think the game was getting stretched. It was so warm. Everyone knew it was going to be so warm. You bring him on with 20 minutes to go. I can imagine the difference it would have been if the roles were reversed with Moura. If Kane was coming on, was it 10, 15 minutes or whatever? I can't remember what stage Moura came on. But if it was the other way around, if Kane is the one coming on the boost, that would have given Spurs. Even with Kane being fully fit, it was a game that was suited better to having that false nine, given the amount of space and the way we knew the game was going to evolve. I just think I think he slipped up there. Don't get me wrong, as a Liverpool fan, I was delighted he started, because he made it so much easier for Liverpool. It could have been a hell of a lot more dangerous. Like the Firmino one was the opposite side with Liverpool. I think it's less of a kind of a decision, really, because with Tottenham, you had Kane and then you had Moura, who's in incredible form. That's a kind of a pretty much on form. It's kind of a like for like, kind of a sort of a swap. You have a player in good form. The other way around, if Firmino didn't start, you're looking at starting Origi. Now, don't get me wrong, he's rolled himself into Liverpool folklore now with some of the goals he's got this season, but it is a big drop down. And the goal aside, he took the goal brilliantly, but his performance was quite poor, and he ended up being pushed out to the right wing, I think with 10 minutes to go, because he kept giving the ball away. So the drop down really from Firmino to Origi is different than what it would have been Kane to Moura. I know for Bobby Firmino did quite struggle, but I think that was a lot down to as well. Yes, he was a match fit, you could clearly see that, but it was a lot the way down to Liverpool kind of played, because Liverpool were unusually kind of direct. They kept pinging balls down the channels, turning in behind the Spurs fullbacks. There was none of this kind of passing play where integrated play where Firmino usually thrives in, and it never evolved into a game that suited his conditions. And it's no surprise that in the end, Origi comes on, because there was so much space there. You know, you want that direct run and get at Spurs, because I thought they kind of struggle every time it was the press. And you know, the goal is, you know, I think I saw the stats afterwards from that angle, it was a 4% chance of scoring the goal. Like, he completely tucked it away, and it's incredible schemes. And you know, I'd probably go to say that the modern day David Fairclough in terms of Liverpool folklore, a guy that was ousted from the club, was sent on loan to Wolfsburg, looked like his career was completely dead, gets drafted from the absolute back of the beyonds for the derby. Like, it was so much so that when he came on against the derby, you almost didn't recognise him, because in that time he'd been out, he had a different hairstyle. He comes completely out of the last ditch. Liverpool were chasing the game. He's literally the only other striker that we had at the moment. He comes on, scores that really, really lucky goal, and, you know, he's scored big goals now against Barcelona. And yeah, he's somehow strangely, like, the last goal, kind of, if you ever wanted to see the involvement of Klopp's Liverpool and how he's able to, I don't know how he managed to do, but keep players that aren't involved so happy and keep them so focused. You had Matic, who was out of the, for large periods, kind of the fourth choice Liverpool centre half at the start of the season. Didn't even play. Like, Clavin was sometimes picked ahead of him last season. That's how far back he was. But he ends up coming into the second half season playing phenomenal, but then assisting Origi for a goal in the Champions League final. It's incredible stuff. You almost couldn't write it.
What's his role next season then? Like, does Origi stay? Does Origi have a spot? Is there a case?
I think there's a statue near the car. Yeah.
<There's> there almost is with the goal. The word on the street is what I've been told by is that he's going to be offered a new contract. He has to be a squad impact player, though. He's nowhere near. No disrespect, he's not good enough to start week in, week out for Liverpool. He's bought into the mentality. I don't know how he's done it. If I was him, I would have been so frustrated with the lack of opportunities and pretty much been ousted. But he's stayed focused. I don't know how he's done it, but Klopp has kept him there, and he's turned into that effective option to come on when teams are, when the game is tired. And, you know, he's that target man. He just gets the ball, and it's nothing skillful or it's nothing kind of out of the ordinary. He just pretty much runs hard in direct lines. He's a good.
If you're Origi, though, you have to be happy that you're involved. Like, I mean, he's not at a level that he should be given out, that he's not.
There was a large periods playing there where he wasn't even involved, though. He wasn't making
the
benches.
But, like, he's not good enough. You know what I mean? He's not going to oust that front three. And then you've got, like, Shaqiri, who was doing so well earlier on this season. I mean, those four are, like, I mean, if you're Origi, you have to look and go, I'm not good enough. But I'm not saying he should know he's not good enough, but, like, I mean, he can't be overly unhappy that he's not getting into the team or the squad based with those four ahead of him.
Yeah, but there was once that there was, like, for large periods, Sturridge was ahead of him, and even when Sturridge wasn't really banging all cylinders, he was still ahead of him. And it was only really since it pretty much, that derby was the light switch moment for him, really, where he went ahead of Sturridge, and Sturridge hasn't played a lot of football in the second half of the season. And the fact that if that's before the derby, and then Liverpool are bringing on a striker, it's probably going to be Sturridge in a different scenario. And Origi's game was a lot better suited to the way the game was stretched and the way Liverpool sat in. But I suppose he's like, the way it is now, and the squad that Klopp has built, and how it's such a young team, and it looks like this could be a tipping point, really, winning this first cup. The potential is there to go on a lot more, and I think players all around Europe are probably going to be looking on, because they're European champions and because Klopp is this kind of star celebrity manager and he has this aura with him, and you see some of the interviews that he's given, players are going to want to sign for him. So the players that are there as well, I'm sure, will want to stay involved, because it looks like there's the potential for special things to happen at Liverpool.
We're going to take a little quick break, and then we're going to talk about that first goal as well, because obviously the handball rules change next year as well. And of course it had a massive impact on the direction of the game, and maybe potentially even on the tempo that was played. Alright, welcome back to Team 33. So still discussing the Champions League final, and a great day in Jonathan Higgins' life, obviously having been there as well. The first goal, obviously, it's the handball, Sissoko's hand pointing out into the nether regions of the world and the pitch. But obviously, a lot of the talk was whether Mane had kind of hit it deliberately towards him. Now, it didn't hit his hand directly first. It kind of hits the side of his kind of his armpit, and then onto the arm. From the TV commentary, I was kind of gauging different reactions. Some people thought it was pretty much a stonewall penalty, and others thought it was quite harsh. Where do you all stand on it?
I think it's harsh, but at the same time, it probably was a penalty.
Yeah.
It's one of those that we've seen over the years where, you know, the referee gives them and legally their penalties, but I think everyone's looked at them and gone, it's not a penalty, is it? Like, you know, for me it should be. You're saying the rules change next year. What's the rule change into next year?
So even ones that are kind of non-accidental, it's still going to be given. So if it touches the hand, and if it's in a completely unnatural position,
it's given.
Sissoko's would be. So under the new rules, Sissoko's would have been given.
And in the old rule, it wouldn't have been.
Not necessarily. It depends what your gauge of unnatural position is, like how far out. Now, his was pointing like down to the other side of the pitch and was quite high up. So in his case, it's quite clear.
I can completely see where the ref gave it because, you know, straight away it looks like a handball. But on VAR, for me, there's an issue there. Like I say, legally it was a penalty, and but still I think VAR has to kind of look at it and go, he wasn't putting his hand up to stop the ball. He had his hand up and the ball went to his arm. Yeah. For me. But we've seen that over the years. It's happened so many times, you know, whenever a penalty is given for a handball, not all the time, but we've seen it so many times that for or against your team that you go, oh, it's a bit dodgy, but legally it's a penalty. And I think that's what it was.
For the neutral, when you look at it, was it too early to give a penalty? Like, did you almost not want the penalty? Did you kind of feel like that would, before the match even gets going? Because obviously I'm looking at this with no skin in the game and I'm thinking, it's just added something extra to this game. Or sorry, it's taken something away from it far too quickly. Like, it's taken a bit of a sting out of it. And that maybe opening 15, 20 minutes of kind of tense, still nil all. Like, it depends what sort of chances, depends what teams grow into the game. Like, straight off the bat, Tottenham are on the back foot and Tottenham are chasing. And it completely changed the complexion of the game.
I couldn't agree more. Liverpool's mindset was to score early. They have scored early a lot of the time against Spurs. And that was the Spurs' reaction that they wanted. It was the worst scenario that could have happened. They wanted to try and keep it close because, as you said, the game had the potential then to go a bit of a free-for-all. It never really allowed to. Initially, just going back to the penalty incident, I was at the far end of the ground. Obviously, you see it and you're not really sure where it hits. You scream. Handball or whatever. Looking back at it and watching the replays, I thought it was harsh, to be fair. I can see why potential is given because his hand is out. I thought he was very unlucky, and I thought it's the type of decision that if it goes in your favour, you're like, yeah, you'll take it. But if it's the opposite way around, you're going to think it's harsh.
VAR has to be looking at it going. Is VAR going by the rule book, in which case VAR had to give it, I guess. But for me, the whole point of VAR should be a bit more, you know, looking at the whole decision and going, you know, was it on purpose?
Sadly, though, with VAR in a decision like that, it's going to go by the letter of the book.
Yeah.
And if you go technically by the letter of the book,
it's a penalty.
But it's kind of one of those where if you take the rules to the absolutely letter of the law, it is. But you've got to, I think with football and, for better or for worse, the rule changes. I can see one reason why they are making the changes, to have complete clarity, whatever. But for me, it's a bit, you can't, the game, there's so much emotion in the game. There's so much things. It's almost like the old argument about referees that haven't played before. They don't understand the game. Like, I don't think he didn't intend to handball at the time. His hand is out. His kind of chest moves forward and it pings off him. It's incredibly harsh. Yes, he could have been a bit more careful. But for me, yeah, it's, look, don't get me wrong, and it went in our favour. Liverpool had the bad luck last season, and is it karma coming back, or whatever you want to put it, or the momentum of the season or whatever. But if you take that incident on its own, it's very, very harsh, and yeah, you can't really say any more. But it had, sadly for the neutral, it had such a big impact in the game because it allowed Liverpool's game plan to kick in, where they just sat back and everyone speaks about Jurgen Klopp only playing one style of football. That's complete nonsense, and we got to see it on the biggest stage there, where they pretty much they sat back and they played long balls down the channel. They sat in, they kept their shape, and it was a very kind of professional, mature performance in the end. I know there was a good bit of luck involved. Alisson made a couple of good saves, but it just felt like at the time there was a couple of wobbly moments, but Spurs kind of felt like one of those games where it's going against you, where you can have all the ball, you can have all the chances, but you just kind of know it's not going to click. You know you're not going to get that opportunity. And Liverpool were able to slow the hell out of the game. There's a lot of streetwise stuff, the dark arts, which for long periods, and go back the last couple of years watching Liverpool, they've been too nice, really. You kind of saw a bit of the gamesmanship. There's a lot of throw-ins there where they completely stalled. They nibbled away at the clock. There was a couple of corners at the end where they rolled down the clock. Klopp made a couple of early substitutions as well. Obviously, the Origi one, which goes on to have a game-changing impact. But also, you know, you got Miller on to slow the game down, and you can even see Miller taking a corner at the end. It was quite funny because it was quite close to him. He puts the ball, looks like outside the box on purpose, and then starts arguing with the fourth official. He's just these little streetwise stuff that if I can put the one deciding factor in the whole game, obviously the penalty incident is huge, but if you'd look at the game as a whole, I just thought you could see, you didn't need to be pointed out to who was playing in their second European final in a row and whose was in their first for a while. I just felt Liverpool were just a bit more streetwise, and Tottenham will learn a lot from this experience, and I've no doubt they'll go on to a lot more. They have a very good coach, and this will be a big learning experience for them, as it was with Liverpool last season.
Yeah, I'm presuming Pochettino stays, of course, which is not a foregone conclusion. He'll probably be there.
It's a lot more of a bigger chance of him staying now than I thought.
Yeah,
a couple of months
there's
back.
There's not many open jobs. Yeah. Obviously, he's not going to go to Barcelona because of his history with Espanyol. Obviously, Real Madrid is not an option, United could become an option very, very quickly, but
by the end of August,
yeah, but no, by Christmas.
Pochettino's not going to leave midterm, though. His type of manager will come in the summer or whatever. So I think he's staying for
but even a yeah, but even looking at Spurs, and I was even saying this to people before they even got to the Champions League final. I was like, there's a new stadium there. They've done very well this season. Obviously, the big thing is getting money to buy players, and that's been holding them back for the last couple of years. If he has got that this summer, and we have to wait and see if he does. There probably will be players going. I was talking to Simon Maguire inside there yesterday, and he's saying that Eriksen is pretty much gone. And there's a couple of other players who are possibly going to go as well. So if they lose those players, they have to bring those players, replace those players, as well as add to the squad and get rid of a couple of other players that could easily leave as well. So they really need investment in the squad this summer. And if they get that, they have a brand new stadium there. They just got to the Champions League final. They've got a brilliant manager and some brilliant players. Even if Eriksen leaves, they've still got Harry Kane, they've still got Dele Alli, who's been poor towards the end of the season, but still he's a very good player. There's a lot of quality in that squad. So if you're Pochettino, I've built this for the last few years. We've been waiting for the stadium to open. That's just after happening. If I get a bit of money, this is kind of where I want to be. This, the whole reason I came to Spurs is this is where I want to be. Saying that, if the United job was open, or if the Real job was open, that is probably the next step up. But they're not, so I don't see why he would go, to be honest.
Yeah, and from Liverpool point of view, obviously they are a super club once again as well. They've had a few years, fallow years there after 2014, particularly when they came close, but they have rejoined that elite, and probably from last season, but it is definitely cemented now, obviously with the trophy, but even beyond that as well, the whole structure of the club just seems almost perfect now. Klopp's probably going to stay a bit longer, sign a new contract, and the sporting director is
Michael Edwards.
Yeah, getting a lot of praise for the work he's done.
Yeah, Liverpool, from such a horrible dark space, they have gone into stratospheres away. The club is in such a strong position on and off the pitch. You look at it from a football point of view, you cannot underestimate the strength of that unity and that absolute die for mentality that Klopp has instilled on the whole squad. He's literally got rid of all the dark eggs. We spoke about the players coming in who hadn't been involved and making big impacts, but there's such a close bond there. It's such a family unit. You cannot underestimate the importance of that. But aside from that, the business side of the game, like, they're going to make another huge profit now. The TV money and the Champions League windfall is going to be incredible. But even leaving that aside, just from a kind of a general football and fan point of view, and I got to speak to a lot of journalists from kind of cover the game, and it's all in all different countries and whatnot. There's a lot, obviously there's a lot of people in over for the game, so it was great just to see it from a different perspective, that, you know, especially as a fan where you've just a one trick mind and you're only focused on one, but to see the overall picture from a couple of different angles. Liverpool are the team that everybody in world football is kind of talking about as almost their second team, say, or the, you know, obviously they're I'll correct myself in there.
Yeah, massively disagree with that.
I'll rephrase it.
You know the point I'm just saying. Leaving your kind of rivalry to one side, as a general football fan particularly from other nations or whatever, where you used to be, what you watch, like Messi and Barcelona, Real Madrid, Liverpool were nowhere near that level. Now they are. Everybody knows about Klopp. The attention, so many different TV networks all around the world were on this game. We're talking about Liverpool. They got coverage up all over the land. They are at that place where, if you're a professional footballer, you're aside from your own team that you're involved, you're probably looking to play under Klopp or join Liverpool. They are becoming that kind of neutrals team where there's a lot of attention on them. And you get to see, like, even just looking, even in Ireland alone, like, you look at some of the scenes where you go. I remember going back not that long ago, maybe 5-7 years ago, Liverpool fans were kind of, it was almost the head down, you wouldn't even acknowledge it. You know, you go back under the dark days there, where through the 90s and even the early noughties as well, aside from a couple of little peaks, but you, for large periods, there isn't really much attention. Now, all the kids want to get Liverpool jerseys. They all want to get Salah on the back of their shirt. They're almost, maybe not, it's nowhere near as extreme as United got in the 90s, but there is signs of that kind of happening. You look at the amount of places that are full of Liverpool fans watching the game, like scenes from all around the world. The club is in a very, very positive. I'm getting smirks all around me here.
But you haven't won the league in 30 years.
That's the next thing. But I think
these are all signs of the end times coming.
I miss
the 1990s, by the way, when we. I say Man United fans, I'm jumping back on the bandwagon hoping such God bring
you'll have a Liverpool jersey on next week. But
you haven't won the league in a long time, so like that's the massive thing. I mean, win the Champions League, we've seen Liverpool did it 14 years ago. 2005 is 14 years ago, it's a bit mad. 2012 Chelsea did. We've seen teams, I'm not saying Liverpool are a much stronger team than Liverpool were in 2005 and Chelsea were in 2012, obviously. We've seen teams win the Champions League. It's about winning the league, and it's about maintaining the league standard, and it's about doing what City are doing, which is winning two, winning three in a row. No team has ever won four leagues in a row. City will be four leagues in a row. I don't think in England at all, certainly not Premier Leagues. City were looking to do that, and it's about that dominance of the domestic league. Listen, winning the Champions League is unbelievable, obviously, but it's about winning the domestic league.
Absolutely.
That has to be the next step.
And
City will strengthen this summer. I mean, we've been saying for years, United will strengthen this summer. United are probably not in that conversation, certainly for next season. Spurs probably aren't either. There are a few players away. Chelsea, if they lose Sarri, aren't. So it's probably going to be that top two again. We don't know. We never know what's going to happen this season, but it's probably going to be that top two again of City and Liverpool. And depending on who City signed this season, they just looked like Liverpool were incredible this season, but City just looked nearly unstoppable as well. So if they strengthen as well, it could be a similar season to this season, next season. Those top two going for it, and Liverpool just have to win the league.
Paramount. Yeah, it is paramount.
You can win another Champions League next season, but unless you win the league,
Absolutely. I totally agree. But what I would say is, look at the Liverpool squad. There's so many players there in their prime that are in their mid-20s that have the potential to go on and be at the top of their game for the next 4 or 5 years. Obviously, injuries and lack of form aside, but you look at the City squad. As good as it is, they need to buy. Like, we don't know what's going to happen with the other stuff, but leave that to one side. They have lost big players, like Kompany is gone. He was an absolute rock in the tail end of that season. It's not going to be easy to replace him.
As a defender and as a leader.
Absolutely.
And Fernandinho.
Fernandinho is not getting any younger. Even Aguero is not getting any younger. So they do have to strengthen key positions where you feel like, and don't get me wrong, Liverpool need to invest wisely in the summer. They need to add a lot of depth to the squad. And that was the missing thing, particularly in that little blip with the draws there around the kind of February, March period before they went on the big run. And in hindsight, was the deciding factor in where the Premier League ended up. They obviously have to strengthen, but there's a lot of the 1-11 that, you know, you look at them, they're in a good place. Where City, don't get me wrong, they have the potential to do, but we've seen teams struggle. We don't know what Pep going to go. There was a lot of talk at the start of the year that he didn't want to be involved in any of the potential negative stuff that might happen. He might go to Juventus or whatever. But they do. It's a big summer for City because they have to strengthen them. Big players and key players as well, but they have the potential to do that. It's going to be, as you said, a very similar season in the league next season. I think if you're looking at it from a City point of view, it's very important that they win the Champions League. That's the next stepping stone for them, and it's roles reversed. It's important that Liverpool win the league. So I think it's all set up for a great battle again. It's interesting to note, Pep. Messaged Klopp afterwards saying, well done, congrats, and we're looking forward to one hell of a battle again next season. So, you know, from the neutral, the Premier League football has never been as strong, and looks like it could be another big battle between the two again. And there's so many teams just underneath it, like obviously United, they need to invest wisely on and off the field, but they have the potential to do that. Such a superpower of a club. Spurs, it's huge for them. They really need to push on. I think if there's anything that you could see in particularly for large periods of the game Saturday night was where you could see was a lot of players had played a lot of football because they didn't sign anyone in the last couple of winners. They need more strength and depth. That's hugely important. Chelsea, God knows what's going to happen there. Arsenal are probably still a bit away, but I think it's
more than a bit away based on the Europa League final. They are awful. A disgrace.
It was a bad it was awful. a bad situation. I thought that
Emery still has a lot of the post Wenger stuff to.
Yeah, but they have no Champions League money.
No, absolutely. I'm not saying, but like Emery, like you can't start judging Emery just yet because he's still got a lot of the squad is there. Obviously, since Wenger was there, it's sort of like it took a long time for you know United to get beyond Ferguson. It's going to take a few years to get beyond Wenger in terms of the players that he brought in. And Wenger, I mean, I was Wenger's biggest fan. You know, biggest supporter, but he brought in an awful lot of poor quality players in his last few years there. So it's going to take a while to move that on. Next season's not going to happen for Arsenal. The big thing for me is Chelsea.
Or the season after that. But
the big thing for me is Chelsea. I mean, like, Sarri earlier on this season looked like he was going to push City and Liverpool all the way, then completely fell away, had that massive blip where it looked like he was going to get sacked, recovered from that, won the Europa League, got third in the table.
Yep.
Third, yeah.
You know what I mean? Had a pretty decent season for his first season there and looks like he's gone now.
Yeah.
You know, and they're talking about bringing in Frank Lampard, who's done a fine job at Derby, don't get me wrong, but really, is he, it's very Solskjaer-esque nearly, you know what I mean? He's done a better job than Solskjaer in terms of what he's done in the past, but like, he didn't get Derby promoted and now he's potentially going to be the Chelsea manager. That sounds like madness to me.
Yeah. It was great to see him though, like, to take, because obviously that clip was going around on social media, to taking the minute to go and have a look at the medal and when he was collecting it on stage. And like, it's been such a long season for him. Like, your heart went out to Sarri for a lot of the season, like being second guess kind of it in all facets of like his management. Had he lost the dressing room? Was he utilising Kante the best way he could? Was he wasting time with Jorginho? Like the whole Kepa situation, the Carabao Cup. Like, you have Eden Hazard, who quite clearly wanted away for large parts of the season. So, like, to come away from that with a third place and a Europa League medal, like,
very good season.
He can walk away with his head held high. And, I think there's a lot more.
You're right. But then this is crucial summer because obviously they're losing Hazard. Mm. So I mean, he's been kind of keeping them afloat for a lot of the last few years, really. Yeah. So if they lose him and they lose Sarri, for example, and bring in Frank Lampard, I mean, that could be just speculation, we don't know, but if they bring in Frank Lampard and don't have Hazard there, we don't know what Pulisic is going to be like in the Premier League. This could be a really big summer for them in terms of who they bring in quality wise and next year
they can bring people in with obviously
absolutely, like, this could be really critical for them, because I mean, For me, Lampard could be an inspired decision. Again, if it happens, we don't know. And we don't even know if Sarri's definitely gone. He looks like he is. But
yeah. If I were him, I'd go anyway.
That's kind of the point, is that this is a very difficult period for Chelsea. And if they lose Hazard next season and don't properly replace him, even with more than Pulisic, then they could be in real trouble. So if I was him, and it's Juve are calling for him.
That's a non-brainer.
And Juve are talking about bringing in Pogba again. Yeah. There's talk of them spending money to bring in the likes of Pogba again. So they obviously have a bit of money there, even without Pogba, to do that. So, I mean, yeah, absolutely.
So I was just curious when you see, like at the beginning of the season as well, what managers are in place. I was going to ask Jonathan that, what teams are the more attractive, or like what would be a more attractive prospect now for a player coming over to England, like if it was between Liverpool and Manchester City, like do you go for the Champions Europe, or do you go for the domestic treble champions? And does it come down a lot to, well, I'm going to make roughly, not maybe the same money just because of the super wealth that Manchester City have, but you're going to make a lot of money either way. So does it come down to a lot of the time just who you want to play for? And maybe when you look at Manchester United, they do have a lot of riches to go and throw money at players, but how much is a certain player going to learn under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer in comparison to Klopp or Guardiola?
Yeah, well, look, don't get me wrong, as a neutral player, it's an incredibly good position to be in if you have the choice of Guardiola or Klopp. I suppose a lot of it is just mindset, really. I'm a little biased, being a big red or whatever. Klopp brings a particular style, a very emotive style. You have the everything that goes with a club that has been culturally involved and of winning trophies, and the fan base that you have, and you only have to see some of the scenes in the celebration, some of the scenes around the stadium in Madrid on Saturday, and the scenes then in Liverpool on Sunday, to see that collective community kind of pride and everything that goes with that, and the stature of the club that has built up over the years. You don't really have that at the moment with Man City. It's a little bit more of a kind of a new industry in a way. I'd know many, like, there's such minute details. I suppose financially, you're probably still going to get the better option with City, because the wealth that they have, it's an incredible. I think it's down to really the player. I think what I would say is, the moment with United being a little away, you're going to attract a player that's probably going to go because he wants a new challenger. He wants a few more bob. I think with Liverpool out of the one is where you want to go, just on probably primarily football reasons alone. City is almost kind of football and financial, and United is probably the challenge. It's such minute details. I guess it's down to the style of the player. Some players will be more, like, they both play kind of similar games, but they're not similar at the same time. There is a lot of kind of differences in the styles. It's a difficult question to answer.
For me, sorry to interrupt, but for me, the difference is pretty much Pep and Klopp. And Klopp is an incredible manager, but Pep is like the manager of this era for me. Over the last 10 years, 15 years, he is this manager. He is, I don't know, he is the Ferguson from the 90s, I guess. I don't know who the previous managers are, but he's a manager who'll go down in history as being the manager of this era. Yeah. Klopp is obviously an incredible manager as well, and maybe in the next 5 years that may change. Mourinho was that manager for about 5 years back in 2004 till about Pep came through, then he got knocked off his perch. But like, for me, it's Pep is the reason you might go to City. The money as well, obviously a big thing. Success is a big thing. But if you're going to pick between Liverpool and City and go for City, it's because of Pep.
Yeah.
I guess the prestige and the culture at Liverpool might swing it in that direction as well. But for me, that's the reason you'd pick City right now, is because of Pep. He's the kind of iconic manager.
Well, if you look at someone like Raheem Sterling, who's come on leaps and bounds, like, just playing under him, and now is, I don't think anybody would argue, is world class on and off the pitch, but particularly on the pitch as well. He's just actually a decent finisher, which he wasn't before. But what we're going to do, just take a quick break, and then we'll be back with the final part of tonight's show. I'm just going to throw a few new rule changes at you and just get your very, very quick opinions on them. All right, welcome back to the final part of this week's Team 33. So, new rules in football. Free kicks, no attacking players in the wall.
Load of nonsense.
Yes.
Eliminate some sort of gamesmanship, doesn't it?
Those scenes are all funny. You see kind of players jostling in, and then
no team who's taking the free kick are allowed in the wall.
They can't have any of their players in the wall.
Okay.
Yeah. Which always leads to contentious scenes as players kind of push each other.
Yeah.
It's good for TV, but
what are you going to achieve by doing this?
I don't know.
Why, like, was the game, like, what was crying out? What examples can you think of that can straight away you can go by, oh, we need to change this?
Have you not heard me calling for this particular change every week on the show?
No.
Like, I've been banging this drum.
No, sadly, I must have missed those episodes. It just seems like change for the sake of change, or having to put forward so many different proposals. I can't understand the logic. Some of the best and the kind of the motor side of the game are those kind of little, like, it's never, like, you've never seen them overspill or anything like that. You might see a little bit of pushing or whatever, but, you know, I go back to Danny Murphy scoring a free kick at Old Trafford where Emil Heskey's in the wall and he pushes two or three players out and he puts it that side. I admire that kind of the little stuff that's off the training ground where they have the couple of players in front and they move aside. I think it's just a bit of fun. I just can't understand the logic behind it. I'm struggling here.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. Like, when you look at a situation where you've got maybe three players in a wall, an opposition player, and then another defender, and it's moved out of the way. I've never seen a case where a goal like that is scored and players in the wall rush over to the referee. I think everyone just kind of accepts it as part of the game, and it's up to the defenders and those in the wall and those, the goalkeeper as well, to kind of defend it. I'd agree. I think it's changed for the sake of change rather than to try and fix something that's genuinely wrong with the game.
Yeah, substitutions. Players must leave the pitch at nearest point.
I do agree with that.
Yes and no, but you wouldn't have that story like when, you know, why Andy Cole and Teddy Sheringham hated each other, because obviously this is a 1995 friendly. Andy Cole goes off the pitch and Teddy Sheringham doesn't acknowledge him. that story would never have happened under the new rule.
Yeah, it's probably a good thing. Two people wouldn't have fallen out because of this.
They would have fallen out anyway. They just didn't like each other.
It slows the game down an awful lot. Listen, it's a tactic that's used, and rightly so, because it's available, but it slows the game down an awful lot, where you quite clearly see a manager telling a player to run into the far corner now, because I'm going to take you off in a minute, and then as soon as you're in the far corner and the ball's out, I'm going to bring you off, and you're going to take ages to come off. And it's great for that team who was trying to run down the clock, but it's really poor. Like, it slows the game down an awful lot. So I think that's a great call.
The one I think won't be policed well, and probably, and there's always been similar rules with the penalty kicks, goalkeepers must have at least one foot on the line. So the general thing is you're not supposed to go off your line, but we've seen it, apart from the time the Ireland under 17.
Yeah.
That one time. We got penalised, but I've never really seen it very often where a referee is actually a stickler for that one.
Unless they are miles off the line. We've seen it the odd time, but very, very rarely. Yeah. It's just how well is that going to be policed? It's all well and good having that rule, but
unless they go to VAR, which I presume will be
for every point is for every penalty. You know what I mean? Like, as in that's the rule already. Is it that, like, you know? So
similar, yeah.
So why not just enforce that rule rather than bring in a new rule? I don't, you know, and maybe not enforce that.
Yeah,
just seems like that rule just needs to be enforced. The original rule,
just
right?
Do your job.
Yeah, just do your job. Don't bring in new rules that aren't also going to be enforced. You know what I mean?
I can't see it being enforced. It's just the way football is.
Absolutely. Again, unless a player is pretty much standing on the penalty spot himself, the keeper, then it generally isn't enforced, barring that one time for the Ireland under-17s, wasn't it, last season? So, yeah, I mean, either enforce the rule with VAR or having a linesman looking at the goal and saying, he's off his line, or else... But bringing in a rule, again, seems to be just, let's bring in a new rule for that.
Yeah, and one more, yellow and red cards for coaches.
Oh, I like that one.
Yeah, like you're sent to the stands.
Yeah, no, there's no longer this get sent to the stand or where you're given a warning. They're actually going to come over and do
that. Yeah, I like that.
Red cards.
Yeah.
And what, the manager just goes back into the dressing room or...
Well, I presume they still get sent to the stands, but now the difference is they will have a red card
ceremonious.
Yeah, ceremonially kind of waved right in front of them.
There's often a lot of confusion about what's happened there, and then you see Jose generally sitting in the stands, or Debbie Fitzgerald in the hurling.
Me?
I like that, but I like the yellow card, you know.
Glad to the drama, won't it?
Yeah, it is. It is good that you see, you know, it's actually a proper warning here, so it's not just... The referee is going over and having a word, and no one really knows what the word is about. This is actually a proper warning.
Yeah.
And when Jose starts shouting again a few minutes later, you know that people will be chanting for him to be sent off.
And the final part of that rule, if in the event of a touchline melee, for example, or melee. However you want to pronounce that.
Melee,
if you want to pronounce
it properly.
Yeah, like the French or something. But if you want to pronounce it like I do, melee. The offending individual cannot be identified for punishment. The senior coach who is in the technical area will be the default recipient. So if there's fist flying, they can't tell who it is.
The manager gets...
Yeah, the manager...
That's pretty harsh, isn't it?
Well, is it like you have to control your staff?
Is it that difficult to identify who's
who's
a guilty party? Phelan, who of course led Manchester United to success, as Killian would say, over a long period of time.
Sam Allardyce.
If he decks somebody, Solskjaer gets sent to the stands.
Yeah, Rashford, Martial, and five of the players get into a big touchline. Scuffle. Solskjaer's nowhere near it. Can't really stop it.
Well, no, I think coaching staff have to be semi-involved in this case.
So, okay.
Like, if a couple of them kind of...
Oh, sorry, this is just coaching staff?
For the most part, yeah. But obviously there are cases where players and coaches like Mourinho poking Tito Villanova in the eye, and then, you know, there was pushing and shoving and all that kind
of
stuff.
Yeah, okay, so this is coaching staff. Yeah. I misheard you. That's slightly more acceptable, I guess, if it's coaching staff. But still, again, yeah, Mike Phelan does something, and then... or two or three people getting a bit of a... Solskjaer gets the heave-ho. That's very harsh on the manager who has,
I don't know, you have to retain control of your coaching staff. I think that's kind of fair enough. Like, if you can keep everyone who is on the sideline with you under with a cool head, like, yeah, because then everyone knows the gravity of the situation. It's not just like, you can get the physio out, or like the manager can almost be like, look, I can't lose my cool here, but like, you go ahead. Like, what's going to happen to you? We can do without one physio, or we can do it if there's two physios on the sideline, we can do it without one. We can, you know, whereas like I'm the manager, maybe it's more from very egotistical managers where it's like, I can't go off the sideline. I couldn't. No way.
Does the manager get the opportunity to identify the guilty party? That's where it could get really interesting.
Or pick a member of staff.
Yeah, you're useless. You're
trust,
no use to
trust
it.
Trust issues. Yeah. It was him. Yeah. Yeah. It's the false physio, false nine, whatever it is. Yeah.
Are we going to change like the assistant manager to like, we'll have two vice managers? So if anything like this happens, Mike Phelan's always gone. Solskjaer gets
Poor Mike getting a lot of suspensions
just,
on his way.
It's just a hypothetical. I couldn't.
Mike Phelan has never been involved in anything on the sideline. Yeah, he's getting ridiculed here.
The worst I saw him do was scare the hell out of Fergie with the balloon
time. Exactly.
Yeah, well, that's a bannable offence.
Is he gets sent to the stands for that?
But anyway, that is it pretty much for this week's show. In fact, I would have assumed, Jonathan, you would have been intolerable given what Liverpool have succeeded in doing, but in fact you were fine.
I'll take that as a compliment. My work mature side came out, I hope.
Oh, it certainly did. I was quite worried about any fans bias coming in here, and I'm just kind of over enjoying it, especially a club that I was taught to dislike as a child.
But don't get me wrong, I'm absolutely delighted. It was a wonderful weekend. It's a big statement for the club. So many people almost crying their eyes out. Is incredible. Football is an incredible thing. You'd almost pity people they don't have in their life, given the weakness of the weekend on and off the pitch. But there we go.
And obviously, Kevin Kelleher as well has to be given.
Absolutely,
Who, by the way, is already playing in the Toulon tournament for Ireland?
Yeah, he played a few days later.
Played yesterday
against China. Yeah,
that's mad. Like when I saw him playing for them on Monday, that's incredible. I mean, how do you even get your head around? You just won the Champions League on Saturday night. Presume had a few points on Saturday night. He would have had to play on Monday from Saturday night, so he can't be celebrating too much. That's fair play to him. I'm not saying it's harsh. Absolutely fair play to him for being able to do that and for being professional enough to do that. Playing for Ireland on
Champions
Monday.
League winner, of course, as well.
Absolutely,
which has to be.
Yeah.
Obviously, didn't play a single minute, but that doesn't matter.
First since O'Shea in 08, it's still we're an island that doesn't have too many winners. It's something to be proud of.
Yeah. But anyway, that's it for this week's show. Jonathan, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Cian.
Thanks for having me, Raf.
Derek.
Thank you, Raf.
All right. Take it away, Johan.